Yeah, I'm here for this. Hello, 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 and welcome back to WNHHLP, WNHH Community Radio. I'm Lucy Gelman, and this is Arts Respond, a collaboration between WNHHLP and the Arts Council of Greater New Haven. I am super excited for my guest today. So you may have seen Adrian Jefferson if you are someone who watches or listens to WNHHLP, and if you're not, you should be, so please fix that. You may have seen Adrian Jefferson on this morning or yesterday. So I am so excited that she is back with me. Adrian Jefferson is the city's chief of cultural affairs. And I messed up that title. She is the director of cultural affairs, Renaissance woman, like all the good thing, all the superlatives. And also Patrick Dunn, who wears many, many hats in New Haven, among which he is the chair of the city's Cultural Affairs Commission. He is also the executive director of the New Haven Pride Center. You may know him as his drag alter ego, Kiki Lucia, or Lucia, depending on how you say it. Yeah. and we are here to talk about the Cultural Affairs Commission, the Department of Arts, Culture, and Tourism, and Patrick just has to hop off. He'll be right back. The Department of Arts, Culture, and Tourism, and the Cultural Equity Plan, which the city rolled out last week. So, Adrian, let's hop right into this, because I've been getting a couple questions from folks who have said to me, okay, like, I get that the city rolled this thing out. I saw your pictures. I saw the article. I saw the press conference. I don't know what cultural equity is. And so let's talk about that. So first of all, can you tell folks who maybe don't understand what cultural equity is, or just are unfamiliar with the language, what do you mean when we're talking about that as a city?
Yeah, and I totally understand. I think a lot of people struggle with what we mean when we say cultural equity. But what I will say, there is a definition offered in the plan. So the first thing I would challenge is, did you read the plan? Because in the plan, there's actually quite a few definitions of what we're talking about and who we're talking about and what this is for. But in short, cultural equity really is about amplifying the voices of the marginalized in the spaces of arts and culture. So, you know, unlike a cultural plan, which really addresses more the economic needs, addresses cultural vibrancy, we're talking about, yes, the economy and yes, cultural vibrancy, but through the lens of amplifying and supporting better our Black and Brown community, our LGBTQ community, our low income community, our immigrant community, our youth and our elderly, and anybody else who has felt marginalized from the traditional arts and culture landscape. So what we're talking about here is equity, right? We're talking about anti-racism, right? We're just talking about that in the sector of the arts. So people might be more familiar with the term of like health equity, for example. And you don't have too many people asking what's that, right? Because they understand, okay, there's equity issues probably in like and poor low income communities or Black and Brown communities. And they're just talking about it specific to health. That's the same thing when it comes to arts and culture and what cultural equity is. That means we're talking about inequities that exist in arts and culture.
And you couldn't hear me, but I was like snapping over here. I was just very excited as you were speaking. So the other thing I've heard is sometimes folks, and yes, this is in the plan, which is a beautiful 52-page glossy document that hopefully Harry Droz can link to. Harry, I will send you that link, and we can throw it on Facebook as well, because it really is something that if you're listening along with us, you should be reading. I've also heard folks use the terms equity and equality as synonyms, and they're not. And so I'm wondering if you briefly can talk about that as well.
Oh, I love the opportunity to talk about the differences. So equality is talking about it as if we've all been granted the same opportunities, like we've all been on the same level playing field, you know, for years, and that we should all get the same opportunities and be able to grow and expand because of the fact that it's equal for all. But equity is talking about the fact that we have not all been on the same leveled playing field, and that there are communities that need a level up and need a little bit more support to level the actual playing field. So that is the difference. Literally, I think the best visual is when you see that visual with people looking over a fence. You have three people looking over. Well, there's a fence. One person has no box, so they can't see over the fence. Another person, I think, has two or three boxes, so they can kind of see over the fence. And another person, they have no box and they can just already see over. They can just already see over the fence, right? So what we want to do is make sure that we're knocking that gate down, that everyone, we don't even need the fence. We're knocking it right down and everyone has access. And so that is the best way I can describe equality in equity.
So Patrick Dunn, I want to bring you in to the, I mean, I always want to bring you into conversations, but I want to bring you into this conversation. So work on the cultural equity plan has been really 2 years, almost exactly 2 years to the date in the process. And you were a member of a 14-person co-creation team that worked very closely with Hester Street, which is a consulting firm based in New York City, known for New York's cultural plan, and then also Civic Impact Lab. And those consultants included Johnny Shively, Elizabeth Nearing, and Eric Ray, who are based in New Haven. Johnny is now a student at Tufts. And that meant getting together because of the pandemic over Zoom and really talking about what you wanted this plan to entail. So I'm wondering if you can talk people a little bit through that process.
Sure. I just want to say that I love hearing Adrian talk, so I'm perfectly fine listening to Adrian. But
I love hearing Patrick talk.
No, thank you so much. And I'm so sorry I had to jump off for a second. We have test kits and a 95 mask being delivered to the Pride Center as we speak. And so I got a call from the delivery truck person from the National Guard. Yes, I was a member of that team, and I just want to just uplift all the members of the team and Biz and Johnny and Eric who facilitated all of our meetings, because honestly, it was a really important factor of me surviving the pandemic, being a part of that group. We had these deep, really emotional at times conversations about what is art, what is equity, how do we talk about artists, who is an artist, why are we including terms like creator, why are we using terms like equity in this process. And honestly, we had some really incredible conversations. I remember there was one meeting where I like got so emotional. And for anybody who knows me, I'm a person of no emotions. And I got very emotional. And I was like, I just kind of broke down and I said to everybody on the committee, it's so incredible to be in this space with all of you, because I committed to myself decades ago that I would never find myself in culture in the United States, because I have too many intersecting identities. And therefore I know when I walk out my door, I will never see myself represented in culture or in art. And it's just not going to happen, because it's just, I'm too complicated from an intersectional perspective. And there might be pieces of culture in different environments where I can be like, oh, my queer part, is represented, or my immigrant part is represented here, or oh, my Islamic part is represented here, right? Like I can find myself, pieces of myself in things, but I know the only place I can find my true cultural representation is in my own living room. And I kind of like had this one, and everybody was like, came around and like virtual hugs and like, and those are the kinds of conversations we had, is like about this idea, because everyone on that committee was so intersectionally representative of our city. I would find it very hard to say that there was a group not represented by someone somewhere in the world. Every neighborhood, every walk of life, every diversity quota, no matter where you fall on the long sentence of why a member of a diverse community, was really represented in the group. And there was always space for me particularly, because I was, there was like, the gays, and that became the slogan for me in meetings. But like, us really came to that space and found ways to represent who we represented from all the people behind us in that space in a really cool way. And it was an incredible process. We used to joke, like, after the process is over, we're gonna just keep meeting on Zoom because we need the relationships. But it was, the process was so dynamic. And I mean, I think we ended up doing like 5 extra meetings more than we were supposed to, because there was just so much conversation that needed to happen and healing that needed to happen within the group, so that we could then be shepherds of what created and bring it out to the broader community and really say, no, this plan is about you. This plan is about everyone in New Haven. It doesn't belong to the city. It doesn't belong to Adrian, even though Adrian was a major component to why it exists. It belongs to all of us as a city. And it is an accomplishment for all of us as a city, as we move forward, as I'm sorry, I'm just going to say it, the cultural capital of Connecticut and one of the most important cultural cities in New England.
Yes.
I got on a soapbox there.
don't apologize. I mean, Patrick, Adrian, both of you know me, so you know that I am going to defend New Haven. I think New Haven is great in spite of Connecticut, not because of Connecticut. And I do, before we continue, I just really want to lift up Patrick, because, you know, you brought this into the space, the members of the co-creation team who are not with us today, but who spoke, many spoke last week at a press conference. So Selwa Abdusabor, Isaac Bloodworth, Hope Chavez, Luis Chavez Brumel, Anderson Curtis, Lizzie Donius, Patrick Dunn, Tegan Engel, that's you, Paul Ryan Hudson, Annie Lynn. I love all these people. Sean McAllister, Rafael Ramos, Fatima Rojas, and Puma Simone, and Ratasha Smith, last but not least.
I just say, I have to give a shout out to, I don't know exactly who put together this group of people, like, and I'm certain there was like 17 minds that came together to, but the brilliance behind how that group was formed also needs to be uplifted. And I'm sure there's many people that we couldn't even name that facilitated that particular group of people or the particular group of people I was part of. But I mean, sorry, I'm going to take up a lot of space again. Just to say again, like, the power of that group, like, when we were talking about cultural equity, we were also talking about things in that meeting, like, well, what does cultural equity look like for someone whose permanent housing is the New Haven Green? What does cultural equity look like for someone who can't feed their children? What does cultural equity look like in an environment where 90% of the state's arts and culture funding goes to 6 organizations, but then the city is flourishing with 50, 60 other nonprofit organizations creating art? Like, we had these really cool conversations, and the idea of, like, again, I said this at the public announcement, this idea that a creator, an artist, can be anyone and is everyone, and art is happening in our city just as much as on the big stages to the crafting space in someone's personal home. And so, like, this idea that cultural equity belongs to every person on that spectrum, from the professional actor that gets imported into our city from out of state down to the creator just working on something in their home. And so I just wanted to say that too, that the kind of, you know, it wasn't just the typical arts conversation process. It really was about relating the arts to every aspect of existence of living in New Haven.
And if I can just build on that, so actually, Patrick, I could answer your question on how that list came to be. So it was really through brainstorming. So when we decided, Daniel and I were talking about this cultural equity plan since before I started, right, when it was clear that I was going to be appointed. So it was announced in January, but I started in February. And so in that in-between space, we were talking about the cultural equity plan. And when I came in, the number one thing that we kept saying is, this can't be led by us, you know, as arts administrators who are in this space, especially me being government and being led by the city, just doesn't feel right. It needs to be bottom up and it needs to be grassroots. And I said, the number one thing that I want to see is that we reach out to the community and pay them for their time to be a part of this plan. Because for the life of me, I don't understand. We pay consultants, right? At all this money, right? And what consultants end up doing anyways is going to the community, why do they go to the community? Because the community, they are the experts. So I was like, well, I want to kind of make sure that, yeah, we'll have consultants come on, but also just as relevant, if not more relevant, is this group of a co-creation team. At that time, we were just calling it a task force that we would pay to lead this plan. So that was always kind of the working of it. So then when we decided we were going to go with Civic Impact Lab, because they are anti-racist and anti-bias, they immediately understood like the assignment. They understood like what, you know, we know exactly who needs to be on this list. And so between Civic Impact Lab, myself and Daniel, we crafted a list. I swear it must have been of 150 potential people. And then based on those intersections of what you're talking about having everything represented, we started to whittle down the names. And then the final group of names really rested on the Civic Impact Lab. They sent it to us. And that's how we got to this point. It was like a collaboration.
Well, and it was so cool because I remember when Biz from Civic Lab, Elizabeth, called me, I said to her, I was like, well, I think it might've even been inauguration day or something like that. Or it was, I remember it being like, I was still working from home after the latest winter wave. And I said to her, I was like, so Biz, I'm really cool with this and really into this, but I want to know who else is on the list because I don't want to come into this space and be either tokenized as the token queer that you want to have on this thing so that somebody can say at the city that I was there. And I also want to ensure that this list's demographics represent our city. So that means no more than a third is white. That means that there's all kinds of income levels. That means there's people with all sorts of different experience. Because I and Biz told me that I think four other people said the exact same thing.
Yep.
And that in itself says the power of the people that were in this space, because the people in this space wanted that space to be what it was from the very moment. And just dangling a consultant fee in front of us wasn't enough for us to just be like, oh, well, yeah, I'll show up, you know? And so I want to appreciate the city and Adrian, specifically you, for your commitment to pay the people for their time, because that was incredible work that was done for the city. And I'll put my chair of the commission hat on and say that it, like the value of what happened in that space is almost not, you can't quantify it in so many ways. And the work that came out of it is so much more valuable than any, you know, traditional consultant the city could have paid.
So I do want to talk about the implementation of the cultural equity plan. So Adrian, you have been on Earth Respond before and have talked about how in sort of a pandemic forced act of reverse engineering, a lot of what's in the plan was already happening before the plan was an official city document, because the pandemic forced you to pivot. And in that pivot, you said, okay, there are people who need to be getting paid. There are really pressing items. And then of course, systemic racism has always been an issue in the city. Historic oppression of people, especially Black and Brown people, has always been an issue in this city. New Haven was aggressively redlined. We still see the scars of urban renewal everywhere across the city. Mm-hmm. So that was not new. That did not happen in 2020. However, the cultural equity plan was sort of in process at a moment of first great unrest. And I think we saw people take to the streets in a really beautiful way. But then there's kind of been this 2-year trajectory where not in New Haven, but in very close neighboring towns, people have lost their minds about things like children's books with Black protagonists and called it critical race theory, which is in fact a very complex and academic theory that is not the same thing as teaching Jerry Craft in your child's school. But that's a whole other episode of this show. And so I'm wondering about the implementation of the cultural equity plan, where I think New Haven is still very much left of center in a lot of ways, but it's also a very divided city and it's an extremely segregated city.
Right. So you want to know about what recommendations we'll take from the plan or?
Yeah, about the implementation of the plan. And also I will say, this is something that at the Arts Paper we have documentation of how the plan came into being. And then of course, some of the recommendations that are in the plan, including putting pressure on Yale, whose endowment grew by $10 billion, with a B, dollars during the pandemic. So while many of us were facing waves of unemployment and death, their endowment was growing to, I think it's $42.3 billion, I think. So I'd love to hear about how you're planning to implement some of the suggestions, which I know also include growing the Department of Arts, Culture, and Tourism, which right. is very exciting.
Yes. So there's a lot of recommendations in the plan, 12 action items in total. I think the first thing we have to do is continue to listen. Because this plan is created, it doesn't mean that it's done. This is actually when the work begins. And so that includes the action items in the plan. And that also includes taking this plan around so that everyone has seen it, everyone has access to it, and everyone can have input into how we implement going forward. So we're starting with a cultural equity tour. The cultural equity tour is actually going to launch in March. March 10th, I believe, is the first date. So we'll be doing March, April, and May. And what we want to do is go around to different pockets of the community and have people convene and gather to be able to dive into the plan, but also hear what we may have missed, what's not in there, what's evolving, how can we reshape, and also suggestions on how we implement the action items. So again, this is a completely community-oriented approach, which there's not much like it, to be honest. There's not something else I can point to because we're doing something that's very different, just that alone, right? And so as far as like the implementation of different action items, there are certain things that we can do immediately, and there's things that we've already been doing. But one of the biggest things that we need to do is the ambassadors. There is a recommendation for neighborhood ambassadors, and that the neighborhood ambassadors would go out into the communities and be connected. And they're already going to be from those communities. They'll come back to us, let us know what is needed, making sure that we get the resources out that are available in workforce and funding, that it's going directly into the communities and cutting through that middleman and just making sure is a direct line of access. So that's a recommendation. That's something I feel like we can do, even if we can't immediately, because it does take time to get a funded position in City Hall. We do have our nonprofit arm, New Haven Festivals, where we bring in contractors, and we can do that immediately. So it's just a matter of going through each of the action items and finding a way to do it. I don't believe in coming up with excuses on why things can't be done. If something has never been done or seemingly can't be done, I'm going to sit down and question, well, how can we get it done? You know, how do we do it? How do we come up with a solution?
And I do want to say credit to, you know, Adrian, you deserve like all the credit, so much credit. But especially where it's due, I love that you came into this position and the city gave you a chunk of money that some in this group might say was insufficient. And you said, oh, well, okay.
Some people, and
you said, okay, I see how the arts are being valued. I'm going to go find money to do this thing. And you did the thing. And so just credit where it's due, because this, I think this is very much a community project. This is something that also would not have happened without the co-creation team. But money, you know, we unfortunately live in a capitalist society, and it's really important that folks were paid for their time, and their emotional and mental labor on this. So I will say, I don't doubt that you're going to be able to find funding for this position.
We will find a way, you know, just like we found a way for most of this, even this cultural equity plan, to be funded through private funders, and the city did contribute as well, and the Arts Council contributed as well. And we found a way for the Creative Sector Relief Fund, where we raised tons of money to get, you know, money in the hands and pockets of artists. We will find a way, you know, because our artists are struggling and they need support. And those are just the artists we know about. What about all the ones who are behind the scenes underground that we don't know about or that they don't know about us, right? How do we provide more access and make sure that it's understood that the opportunity is here? Or how do we do better with getting the access to the people?
Yeah. So I want to switch gears just a little bit. And if you're just joining us, this is Arts Respond on WNHHLP 103.5 FM New Haven. My guests today are Director of Cultural Affairs Adrian Jefferson and Patrick Dunn, who you may know as the Executive Director of the New Haven Pride Center or the Chair of the City's Cultural Affairs Commission. Adrian, I want to switch just a little bit and talk about the city's second annual Unapologetically Radical Conference.
Yes.
Which fortunately is happening. Unfortunately is happening online, but that's where we're at,
I
right?
Know.
But that's where we are. You know, the pandemic is a moving target. A year ago, if you'd said you're still going to be doing everything virtually in a year, I don't know if I would have wanted to believe you, but here we are. And this is what we're doing. I'm really, really excited for this conference. And I'm wondering if we can talk a little bit about what folks can expect on February 19th. And I will say registration is open. We will drop that link as we're speaking about it.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to talk about this because I'm excited too. The Unapologetically Radical Conference, it really was created to infuse hip hop in like the entertainment world of arts, which is a discipline as well, and fuse it with social change initiatives and social justice and amplifying arts for anti-racism and really talking about that the role that the arts plays in eradicating racism, right? But also, this is about what you'll see is a lot of different artists who are from the community talking about these really central issues that they are facing or their communities are facing and really coming up with solutions around these issues. So this conference, this year, we're gonna be featuring Tamika D. Mallory, who is, you know, for those who know her, you know what she's about, social justice movement leader, movement strategist, just absolutely phenomenal being on the front lines. So we're going to hear from her. And then we're going to have a whole bunch of different panelists, many of them, most of them actually from New Haven, talking about critical race theories, which you referenced earlier, talking about preserving Black and Brown stories and cultures and how there is a lot of legislators trying to remove, you know, block critical race theory. We're going to talk about the cannabis industry and how a lot of Black and Brown people are being kept out of an industry that they helped build. And many of them, while we're capitalizing on that, many of them are being locked up behind bars, but no one's talking about that inequity, right? We're going to be talking about anti-gentrification, buying back our blocks, wealth building and getting businesses in the Black and Brown community that can scale, that are sustainable. And so all of this is going to be coming from the panelists who like live this, breathe this, and want to see this in their communities. So we're just glad to bring it back. And what I will say, this is a space that is a safe space for Black and Brown and marginalized communities. And it's also a space for people who want to learn. You know, there's so many arts and cultural institutions who have started to embed arts for anti-racism in their organizations, and they don't sometimes know where to start. The best way you can start is embracing the culture and immersing yourself in a culture you may not know and being open to learning and listening. So this will definitely be a space to do that. And it's going to be fun, a lot of fun.
And I also want to say, so there are so many magic words in what you just said, but generational wealth is one of them. And I will say the cultural equity plan is part of this and actually part of building wealth among artists and creatives. And I'm wondering if Adrian, you can speak a little bit about that. So the city last week on Wednesday, one day before the announcement about the cultural equity plan, announced that it had an outline of how to allocate $53 million of funding from the American Rescue Plan, which is of course a huge federal relief package, some of which about $115 million of which is coming to New Haven in different chunks. And of a $10 million chunk that is in that $53 million, it's going to building wealth. And then within that $10 million, there's a portion for the cultural equity plan. And I know there are people out there, because I have talked to and fought with some of them, who have said, well, I don't understand how paying artists is related to building generational wealth. So I'm wondering if you, oh, you don't need to convince me, Adrienne.
Yeah, it just bothers, I know I don't have to convince any, not you, not Patrick, and probably so many people who are listening that I don't have to convince, but it literally boils my blood when I hear that, because it shows me that people really are not aware or educated around how much money of an industry that the arts contributes to our economy. In this state alone, we are close to being a $1 billion economy. So the arts ecosystem brings in $1 billion. We're almost to that number. Had it not been for the pandemic, we probably would have been at that number. And Patrick would love this because, again, cultural capital of the state, all right, us being the cultural capital of the state, we have contributed significantly to that number. We take up a lot of that space, and that reason for cultural tourism, the reason people come here is for arts and culture, right? When people come for arts and culture, guess what else is benefiting? Our restaurants, our hotels, our local businesses. So this is a part of an ecosystem. And actually, we are stronger than other industries that are our core sector industries are front facing. We actually contribute more in many ways. So there's a lack of understanding there. So you have to understand that first to understand how that is connected to wealth building for Black and Brown communities, or for any community at that. We're talking about job creation, right? And not just jobs in the arts, because you can take artists and place them in other sectors and that sector will thrive better. It has been proven. There's data for that. So I could go on and on about how this is all tied to economics. And when we talk about leveling the playing field, we have to talk about economics for Black and Brown people. And we have to talk about closing the wealth gap. You know, I'm passionate about that. Sorry.
Did you just apologize?
No, not really. Mm-mm. I'm not really apologizing. It's just a habit.
No, we just talked about being unapologetic. Mm-mm. I'm not having. We're gonna apologize too much. It is the end of the week. Mm-mm. Yeah. So Patrick, I also want to bring you into this, because one of the things that that you do in your, I don't know if you sleep ever. But one of the things that you do is chair the Cultural Affairs Commission. And I've talked about that with some people and they've said, huh? Like, what's that? And so, first of all, I'm wondering if you can tell our listeners a little bit about what the city's Cultural Affairs Commission is. Let's start there.
So I'm gonna start by saying that I'm gonna talk about what the Cultural Commission is right now, because I think that's all. Well, it's not all that matters, but that's what I can one speak to. But also, I was one of the people that went, "Huh," a number of years ago, and so intellectually, I was aware and knew that something like that probably existed within the city, but was not fully aware of its function or existence. So that's why I'm going to talk about what it is today versus its long history of existence. And what it is today is really a group of individuals that are passionate about the vision in which Adrienne and Kim bring to the city about connecting our community in shared experiences through arts, culture, and tourism opportunities that bring us together and move our city forward as we continue to take a leadership role as one of the most important cultural cities in all of New England. To me, that's what it is. And I see my role as a commissioner and my role as the chair to uplift what Adrienne and Kim are trying to do, to find them and connect them with resources in the community that they may not know about and or cannot access for a variety of good, bad, and indifferent reasons. And I really feel that, as you know, we do this thing at every meeting, but we started it last meeting, but it's moving forward in every meeting, is I really feel it's really important that every commissioner asks themselves once a month, what am I doing this month that makes a difference in Kim and Adrienne's work? What am I doing this month that is advancing the work that they're doing and supporting them? So I still haven't done my thing this month, but I have 2 weeks to do it until our next meeting. But no, really. And so we, every meeting now, there's a, on our agenda, it's the commitment from each commissioner to what they're going to do in the next 30 days that advance the goals of the department and the commission of uplifting our community and bringing arts, culture, and tourism, specifically arts and culture, the tourism, there's other people that deal with that, but bring that into our city in a way that is equitable and advances our city. And I think, you know, Adrian and Kim, when they asked me, I said that I thought they were crazy because I'm going to come in there and make a lot of noise and turn over some tables. And they're like, no, that's what we want.
That's what we want.
You know, it's very interesting to be in this role for me, because for years I have been told that I'm not an artist by arts leaders. For years I've been told the work that the center does in the arts and culture sector, which, you know, in the last 2 years since the pandemic started, just going to put it out there, has invested more in artists than any other arts organization or art body in the state. I think we've actually paid artists more than the Arts Cultural Fund has. Big on the fund, but I'm just saying we've exceeded 100,000. And being told we're not worthy of arts funding, we're not worthy of being called an arts organization, right? And so for me to be in this role, I see it as a dual purpose. I see it as continuing my work as part of a member of the co-creation team, an avid supporter of Adrian and Kim and all of the work that they are doing and their vision for what the city is. And then there's a role that it is activism for me. It is standing up and being like, no, you think I don't belong here, but guess what? I'm sitting right here with the gavel, right? And so I think that as Adrian and I and Kim have been talking about, like, how do we recruit more members? Who else does need to be a part of this commission? There's a lot of that in mind also. So we've been excited to invite and have people joining the commission over the last couple of months and in the coming months that are going to be continuing to represent this vision of cultural equity, continue to represent this vision of one city unified, and having people from different parts of our city that represent, again, that intersectional nature of the work that needs to happen in our city at that commission table. So that's what the commission is.
I was going to say, I do want to shout out the fact that the commission is more diverse and more queer than it has been either ever or in several years, and more reflective of New Haven. So in the past couple months, Patrick, last year we saw not only your appointment, but we saw the appointment of Hope Chavez and Magali Cahigas. Magali may be best known for, she wears lots of hats around the city. She's a very engaged mom. Her kids have gone through Cooperative Arts and Humanities High School. She also grew up in New Haven, and she's a really vocal and important member of Puerto Ricans United and has just done tremendous work with them for years and years and years. And then Hope is she still a production associate, or is she may have been promoted? Hope, if I got your promotion wrong.
Associate artistic director or something. It's very, very, very fancy.
Yeah.
But I would also be remiss to say she is also a member of the New Haven Pride Center board.
Yes. I will say, Hope, if you're listening and I just messed up your title at Long Wharf Theater, I am very sorry, because it's a very fancy title. But I will say we're really lucky that, and then Alder Alex Guznay, who represents Ward 1, because that's where he lives now, but grew up in Fairhaven, so also straddles Ward 14 in a really interesting way. All of these folks are bringing new voices, new vision to the Cultural Affairs Commission, and it's a really exciting time. And I don't get, as a reporter, I should get excited about every city commission, but I can tell you that having sat through a lot of city commission meetings, especially on Zoom in the last 2 years, that is not always the case. And it's a commission I'm really excited to listen to and to learn from. Adrian, I also want to talk to you about funding that's coming into the city through the Arts Council of Greater New Haven. So the Arts Council was lucky last year to receive a $500,000 grant from the National Endowment of the Arts. And yes, that is money to be re-granted into the city. So if folks don't know about re-granting, we should have a whole other episode about the minutiae involved in that. But I will say the Department of Arts, Culture, and Tourism is getting a chunk of that and is piloting a really exciting initiative. And I'm wondering if you can tell listeners a little bit about that initiative.
Yes, we are piloting the Creative Workforce Initiative. It is designed to look very similar to the state's program, which is the Arts Workforce Initiative, Actually, I helped to, I launched that program when I worked at the state, and it is still running. And that program really is about getting people in jobs, in access to jobs in arts and cultural institutions or in other sectors where they can do arts administration or other arts, be interactive in the discipline they want to grow in, and get paid to do it. So it's like paid apprenticeships, but it also serves another purpose, right? You're paying this person who will thrive and hopefully sustain in the arts, but you're also helping the organizations who have a lot of gaps in resources sometimes into hiring talent or even to finding talent. You're helping from that lens too. It also helps to diversify the pool that they get, the resume pool that they would get. Traditionally, arts organizations are using the same list. But if we can put a more diverse candidate group in front of you and show you the different talent that's out there, then your organization will really benefit from these new voices. And so that's what this Creative Workforce Initiative will do. We're still ironing out the details on like what the age, age capacity might be, how many people, how many institutions and arts and cultural spaces can we place people in? But that's the, you know, that's pretty much the gist of it.
And I want to ask both you and Patrick, so we have about 10 or 12 minutes left, you know, and I hear these words like creative workforce. And I will say, as someone who has an extremely broad lens on arts and culture, I get pushback from people, like probably multiple times a month. It used to be sometimes multiple times a week on whether something actually constitutes arts and culture. Mm. And so I'm wondering, you know, from both of you, what that means for funding arts and culture in this moment.
Before you answer that question, Adrian, but I was gonna say before you answer, I just want to give a big shout out that I love that the city is doing this new program. Adrian knows that I'm a massive fan of the state program. We actually got one of our most valuable teams, Laura Bocadoro, through the state program, and Laura was the second employee the center ever had. And it was because, and the I would say almost the expansion of the center that has happened to this point was accelerated because of that state program. If that state program had not given us Laura at the pivotal time as what was essentially a free employee to us, we likely would not have been as prepared as we were when it came to COVID-19, which ultimately would have meant that we would not be the organization we are today. So I am so, so excited that this program is coming to the local level from the big state level, and that Adrian is bringing this, because this program gives incredible opportunities for the people in the program, but it literally can be pivoting for a nonprofit that gets the opportunity to participate. So I just wanted to throw that out because I'm super passionate about this.
Yes, Patrick is always so passionate about it, but and so are other organizations who have benefited in that way, where it really has been foundational, it's been transformational in reshaping the organization or expanding programs. So it's always good to hear those stories, especially for the people who are placed there and they're able to actually now have a job in that. Like we're talking about changing someone's life, putting money in their pocket. And you know what else we're talking about? We're talking about retention, right? A lot of the question is, how do we keep people here? How do we not lose people from to New York or to Boston or, you know, Atlanta, right? What do we have here for people to thrive in the arts workforce? But I was going to say, Patrick, you'd be the perfect person to answer that question that Lucy asked.
Ask the question again. I'm sorry. I got so excited to say what I was saying.
No, that's okay. Because Patrick, I will say I have fought people on drag. Like I have fought other writers on the legitimacy of drag. And so that's one of the things I'm talking about. When we talk about arts, funding arts and culture, and I, you know, bless if there are any, I would say older white gentlemen out there who have sent me some interesting emails. You know, take note right now. But when we talk about funding arts and culture, how broad is that lens? How broad is that lens?
So for me, I think that it should be as broad as possible, because the reality is that art and culture as we think, as many people, not we, we here think of it as very broad, but art and culture is the way in which a lot of people see it, or the lens it must be through for them to identify it as art and culture, right? Is foundationed in and held up by all of the other art that is not funded. And it could not exist if those other things didn't happen. Meryl Streep was not Meryl Streep on the day she was born. She did community theater. She did this, she did that. She went to Yale. She went here. She did that, right? She did all these things that brought her to the place that now she is this Oscar winning actress. You think of someone like Lupita Nyong'o, and I'm using her as an example because she is a person who went through New Haven and was very active in New Haven's art scene separate from her experience at Yale, who went on to win an Oscar for an incredible film, 12 Years a Slave. If you have the emotional bandwidth to watch it, it's an incredible film. But Lupita, who was born in Africa, who started in grassroots African art tradition, is now in this space where she's leading. She's been in Marvel movies, right? So like, when you think of big art, you think of Schubert, you think of the symphony, you think of all these incredible organizations around our city that are seen as the big eight, as many of us like to call them. They're able to be the big eight because all of these other artists and art makers around them are creating an environment where we have a city that flourishes on art and culture. I'm not a person that likes to talk about the economic impact of art because I don't think we should have to quantify art and economic impact. However, I understand that some people need to hear that, and I appreciate that. But to say that it's not a cultural festival because it's pride, but that it is a cultural festival because it's the cherry blossom festival is bullshit. I know I'm not supposed to swear, but I'm just saying there is just as much valid art, if not more, happening on the stage of the same events that are maybe two blocks apart from each other in this city, right? The valid art that is happening on the stage at Partners Cafe when five drag queens and a drag king take the stage is just as valid in storytelling and perhaps more representative of our community here in New Haven than what may happen on one of the traditional stages or the traditional arenas in our community, right? Uh-huh. So I don't say that to say we need to take away all the money from the big eight and give it to everybody else. I mean, I think that we need to evaluate the way in which we are spreading wealth, right? Yeah. Wealth equity is, and going back to what Adrian was saying, like, right, that's how we get rid of things like wealth gap and intergenerational poverty is looking at wealth distribution. But with that said, I'm going to say the same thing I said the other day when we did our launch, invest in culture. Because when we as a society invest in culture and we stop fighting for the crumbs, right? I say this in the queer community all the time. We need to stop playing the my pain is worse than your pain Olympics. The arts industry, the culture industry need to stop the, well, Longworth gets 20 times right. What we get. And that may be true. And we may need to have a conversation about that in the community. But our front to the world should be, we need $10 million more dollars in the community. Or $100 million more. Or however much more we need to ensure that there is equity across the board. I know that the New Haven Pride Center's budget is not as big as, let's say, Longworth, because I just said them and I'm supposed to have lunch with Jacob shortly, right? Like, I know our budget isn't the same size. So no, we should not get the same $1 million theoretically that they're getting because their budget is bigger and there's costs that are very different. I don't say that because what they do is better or what we do is better. It's different. And until we can look at how we talk about art and culture through a cultural equity lens and talk about specifically funding through a cultural equity lens, we're going to continue to have this struggle of the high art that is fundable and the low art that is not. And we're going to continue to have drag entertainers who have to be costume designers, sound mixers, performers, dancers, in some cases not me, I'm old, gymnasts, comedians, live singers, hairstylists, makeup artists, all at the same time living below the poverty level and having to maybe engage in sex work, maybe engage in underground economies to survive when an actor on a stage that is traditional can be paid 50 to 100 times what they make for their time. And when and we will always have artists who are paid a different standard of minimum wage than everyone else. And that's my soapbox. And thank you for coming to my TED Talk.
I'll just have a few things to add. I think
yes.
What Patrick hits on is the scarcity mindset that happens in the arts and culture community, specifically with our arts and cultural institutions in this state. You know, if you look at the state of Connecticut line item, okay, the line items, we are the second state that has the largest amount of line items that go to arts and cultural institutions. And why that's a problem is because that means not everyone's showing up on that line. It's only That's specific right. ones who have access to legislators, who have a little bit more power and know how to get access to get that line. So that is not equitable. So if we're able to say, no, we need the entire arts and culture landscape needs more money, and it needs to be we need to distribute that money in an equitable way so that everyone's organization, which especially the ones who help artists, a community artist can thrive, then that's when we're winning, right? So that's very important. Also, I think it's important to remember, especially when we're talking about identifying and trying to label what arts and culture is. Number one, we can have that argument all day. No one ever is able to do it because people have so many different perspectives on what it is and on what it isn't, right? Also, I think it's important to keep in mind that right here in the United States, arts and culture has been designed around white supremacy culture. It has been westernized. Okay, so when we're talking about, the type of arts that happens here in this country, well, there's a whole history behind why that art has been central. And so what we're doing is disrupting that. And we're saying, no, we have a melting pot in the United States of different cultures, different intersections, and we need to represent all of that. And some of which won't look like what it's looked like for the past 100 years. So that is important too. So that's kind of what my pushback on that is. I think for so long when we're in these conversations, something that's not a part of the conversation is like creative entrepreneurs, creative businesses, those who are not nonprofit arts organizations. They are for-profit arts organizations, and they're not a part of these conversations, and they should be because they are also a part of our arts community and our arts economy. I've had people say, well, I don't think that arts, they should be funded because they're businesses. They don't have the same struggles. That's not true. The only difference is the filing steps. Okay. So it's there's a lot of problems there. And this is like could be a whole episode because there's so many things that are just misconceptions that we need to unpack about how people view arts and culture.
And I love what you just said, Adrienne. I love the idea that creative and entrepreneurship be considered part of arts and culture. And I will push that even further and say, like, a culinary institution, any restaurant in New Haven is a vital component of the arts and culture scene and should be seen that way and be valued that way and uplifted in that way. And, this conversation and whenever I have this argument with someone, right, somewhere about what is art and all that, I always think of the scene from Mona Lisa Smiles, which is one of my favorite art films. And in it, they say, well, what is, who says or art is not art until someone says it is. And Julia Roberts' character goes, it's art. And the student's response is the right people. And that is what needs to go away. There is no right people, right? We can have conversations about aesthetic and why someone maybe doesn't like a certain kind of art all day long, right? There are things I don't like that maybe everybody else likes, right? But to devalue what someone is creating to the point where you are now eliminating it from even being in the room, which unfortunately happens a lot, particularly, and I'm not calling anyone out or sending hate to anybody, but particularly in the way our state government makes decisions about art funding. It just is what it is. Adrienne knows this. She's been on many an email where I have sent nasty emails about these things. And, it's something that we have to keep pushing back against because that's where we will really see fundamental change. And, I'm going to push again Adrienne's definition a little further and say where the story isn't about a white, cisgendered, straight, able-bodied, older man.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you both so much. We are out of time.
Are we out of time?
I know. I wish we had 4 hours to talk about this, but this is Arts Respond on WNHHLP 103.5 FM, New Haven. See, I got that FCC station ID in. My guests today have been Patrick Dunn, Executive Director of the New Haven Pride Center and Chair of the City of New Haven's Cultural Affairs Commission, and Adrian Jefferson, who is New Haven's Director of Cultural Affairs. We are so lucky to have both of them with us. Thank you and have a beautiful weekend.
Thank you.
Bye.